Hello and welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. This afternoon, we welcome back Bob Berman. He's an astronomer. He's an author. He's a funny guy at times. I think you'll enjoy the program if you've not heard Bob on this show before, although he seems to be on every other day. 1-800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551. Or you can also post your comments on Facebook. It's facebook.com, don't you know, / WAMC Radio. You could tweet us at WAMC Vox Pop or email voxpop at WAMC.org. But again, the number is 1-800-348-2551. His latest book is Zoom, How Everything Moves, and it is out on paperback and in many different forms and languages around the world. Bob Berman, welcome back. Was it yesterday that you were on? No, it wasn't that long ago,
life is just passing like that. That's what's happening now. Time is, we're celebrating, you know, Einstein's 100th anniversary of general relativity by our lives zooming past at a faster rate.
It happens quicker and quicker as you get older. And, of course, not only did I, this show's off to a great start. Not only did I manage to get the name of the show wrong at the top of the hour, I also got the date wrong. It is the 3rd of December, not the 2nd.
Uh-huh.
You see, it's in the script, and I'm like Ron Burgundy. I'll just read it. She could have said July 17th, and I would have said it's July 17th. But now we're on to the ad-lib portion of the program, and all bets are off. Catalina, the Catalina caper, right?
Yeah, things are coming up. Great things in the sky. One of them, we're not sure if it's great or not, but a comet. Every 15 to 20 years, we get a great comet. That adjective doesn't mean like, hey, shucks, that's great. It means it's a scientific term. It means bright enough to be seen over cities. No telescope, no binoculars are needed. We had two in a row. We had Yakutake and Hale Bopp in the mid-90s. Now we're overdue. Now it's 20 years later.
They didn't seem that great
to
me. I'm sorry.
They didn't. What about Hale Bopp?
Hale Bopp was okay. I mean, but I had to go out into the country with dark skies to see it with the naked eye very well.
I thought it was great.
I thought it was, you know, mediocre. I want to see.
Well, we're looking for another one in any case.
Right.
And we thought maybe Catalina would do it. And here it is. It's going to either bust or perform. It's swung around the sun 2 weeks ago, passing its close point perihelion. And now in the coming weeks, these are all the milestones. Right now it's to the left of the star Spica in Virgo. You'll see it in the morning. You have to get up before dawn.
With the naked eye?
That's the question. It's expected to brighten. We thought it would brighten more than this, frankly. Somewhere around magnitude 5 or 6, which means definitely catch it with binoculars. Here are the tests. On the 7th, that's Monday, Pearl
yep.
Harbor Day, it's going to be right next to Venus, the brightest thing in the pre-dawn sky. So you look toward the east, you find Venus. That's easy. Point binoculars there. And there's the comet through binoculars. And it'll either be great or it'll be a little blob or maybe you won't even see it at all. We'll find out. And then after that, it keeps heading north. It's going to pass, you know, the famous star Arcturus on January 1st. It'll be our New Year's Day, and then closest to Earth on the 12th, when it'll be about 70 million miles away. So it could be bright, could be naked eye. We'll see. That's always fun.
So what makes a comet bright or dim?
Well, a few things. If it's the first time visiting the solar system, which is the case here, it's been millions of miles on its way inward to it. It's going to whip around and then go out and never return. So that helps.
Why? Because it's not stripped of stuff as it goes around the sun?
Exactly, exactly. Its ices are fresh. It's virginal. It's going to just react with the sun's heat for the first time and energy. And there's only one periodic comet. That's the famous Comet Halley.
Yeah.
Every 76 years that puts on a good show. And that does return once
that was underwhelming as well the last time.
We were on the wrong side of our orbit. This was the worst visit by Halley's Comet in 2,000 years. But in 2061, we're going to get a really great visit. And in 2137, it should be the best in the last 2,000 years. So just the wrong lifetime for that.
Well, my grandmother said that, what was it, 1910?
Interestingly
enough. She said it was
enough,
amazing.
And my grandmother said the same thing. We both had elderly grandmothers, interestingly.
Well, not at the time, but...
Not at the
Right. And not now either, actually.
Yes. And the interesting thing is that year was one of the extraordinary years where there were two great comets. There was the great January comet of 1910, which was brighter than Comet Halley later that year. So a lot of people thinking back remember the January comet and say, yeah, I remember.
What was that
comet
one?
Halley. Well, they called it the great January comet. But with Halley, the interesting thing is we were passing through the tail of the comet that year. And it had just been found that the greenness of comets are largely caused by cyanogen, which is a deadly gas. So many thought the end of the world was at hand. You know, that thing.
Yeah.
We get that every few years,
sure,
even now. And so comet pills were being sold that was supposedly protective from the our atmosphere being poisoned by Halley's comet.
By cyanide.
Exactly.
The pills aren't going to work.
And yeah, and it turned out they weren't needed. So the only consequence of Halley's comet was World War I that it caused.
Oh, well, okay.
But other than that, no.
I don't think that's great.
There was no consequence. So comets are very cool. And then comets, debris, causes meteor showers. And that's the segue because we're about to have the year's best shooting stars. And a lot of the, in the media and almanacs and websites, including our own community observatory, SLUR, as guilty as all the rest of them in hyping minor meteor showers. I know the AOL welcome screen will say, go out tonight, you'll see lots of shooting
stars.
Hang on,
you're still on AOL?
I have to be, Ray. I have no choice.
Okay, I don't want to know why. But
because just... where I live, the power goes out so often, only AOL can still use dial-up if you have to.
Ah, what about CompuServe? Have you tried that?
I remember.
Okay, CompuServe. So anyway, getting back to your point.
So we're going to have so minor meteor showers, meaning there's just a few per hour, you barely notice them, often get headlines. So with that in mind, it's rare to actually get a genuine, fabulous meteor shower. And so let's not let this one pass unnoticed. This is going to be the best of the year. There should be two shooting stars per minute.
Okay.
At maximum, and you don't have to wait till midnight. With the Perseids every August 11th, the great summer famous meteors, they get going around midnight.
Yeah.
They increase in intensity. Not these. Plus, the moon is going to be absent. So you've got dark, perfect conditions. You have a shower that's going to start at 8 or 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
You should have as many as two per minute if you're out in a dark sky away from city lights. And all of that will be the night of December 13th to 14th.
Okay.
That is Sunday night, a week from Sunday.
All right. I'll bet you a beer we have clouds and rain or snow.
You know, I've never had a glass of beer in my life.
Really? Then I'll bet you two. No, usually what happens is we'll have clouds and we'll miss the whole thing.
I hope not.
All right, let's hope for clear skies the night of the 13th. And you're predicting here on this program, for the record, it will be a good meteor show.
Oh, it definitely will be. It's the best.
And how can you say definitely?
Because it's up and coming. Oh. The Perseids, which have been seen for thousands of years, they were noted by the Chinese of old a few millennia ago. These are strange, Ray. They were not even seen until the Civil War. They started to appear only a few per hour, and then they got more and more abundant. And it turns out that this is a swarm of debris from an odd object. I just said earlier that meteor showers are debris from a comet.
Right.
But this one, you couldn't find the object. Finally, I think it was 1983 when we had a orbiting satellite that found this strange asteroid, Phaethon, that isn't a comet at all. It at least doesn't have a tail. And this has the same orbit as the debris that causes the meteor shower. So its origin seems to be an asteroid-like object. Some think that, well, it's a comet that lost all of its material.
Yeah.
And all that's left is a core. Others think, well, maybe it's an asteroid that accreted material and that falls off. Mysterious stuff. Phaethon. But regardless of what causes it, there is no meteor shower these days that's getting better and better and better. Each year, the material is moving inward. All meteoric material spirals inward toward the sun, called the pointing Robertson effect, because the pressure of sunlight makes them lose energy.
Right.
And losing energy means they're falling inward toward the sun. So this material is right on the edge of our orbit, so it's moving inward each year and becoming a better, denser, more spectacular shower.
All right. So, and you really have no way, other than a general, this will be good, you have no way of saying this will be really, really good.
No, except the moon is the spoiler. Usually the moon will be absent
right
this year.
Okay. All right. So, well, let's see. We have about a minute to go before the break. Rather than jump to the calls, Let's go through another one that I saw here in the Astronomy magazine, which I understand you have something to do with. Now, did you see this about the supermassive black hole snacking on a star? This is from astronomy.com. Scientists have discovered a hungry black hole swallowing a star at the center of a nearby galaxy. Supermassive black hole was found to have faint jets of material shooting out from it and helps to confirm scientists' theories about the nature of black holes. What did they find out?
Well, I think the galaxy actually was, if I remember right, about 300 million light years away, which isn't really that near.
No.
And the one thing, even though we're finding out how material is falling in, let's remember that black holes don't really exist. What we're seeing are almost black holes, because the final material that would produce a black hole, since we're celebrating Einstein's 100th anniversary of general relativity,
yeah,
he told us that time passes differently there than here. So to become an actual genuine black hole, as the material is falling in to reach black hole density, everyone outside of that point, which is the rest of the universe, including us as observers, don't see that happening. We see the material falling in and time freezing. We see a frozen star. We don't see the formation of a black hole. We see an almost black hole, and then the whole process stops forever. For a minute, it'll take infinite time for a real black hole to form, and infinite time hasn't yet passed.
You're killing me already. You know, I'm sorry I asked. Let's take a break. 1-800-348-2551. Berman, you've done it again. You've confused me. It only took you 20 minutes.
Support for WAMC comes from the Albany Pine Bush Preserve, presenting interactive exhibits, 20 miles of outdoor hiking trails, and programs on ecology, natural, and cultural history of the pine bush, albanypinebush.org. Interim Healthcare, providing companions, aides, and nurses in the home 2 to 24 hours a day so you or a loved one can stay in your home. Supporting the Mohawk Hudson Land Conservancy, interimhealthcare.com. Rhinebeck Artist Shop, professional picture framing and fine art materials, art sets, and stocking stuffers. Rhinebeck, New Paltz, and 793 Broadway in Kingston. RhinebeckArt.com. Destination Williamstown, a calendar of curated events in the Northern Berkshires, culture, college, cows. DestinationWilliamstown.org. And Curran Compliance Services Incorporated, Greenwich, New York, and St. Paul, Minnesota. National compliance and regulatory consultants for life insurance carriers and their distribution partners. CurranCompliance.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC, 800-348-2551, the number, or you can email us, voxpop@wamc.org. Bob Berman is our guest, and you ready for the phones, Bob?
I'm ready.
All right, here we go. Julie in Saratoga Springs. Julie.
Hey, Bob and Ray, it's such a pleasure to speak with you both. I leave tomorrow for the Southern Hemisphere, and it's always been a dream of mine to see the constellation, the Southern Cross. But I'm a virtual astronomical idiot even in the Northern Hemisphere, so I do know like the North Star and the Big Dipper and Orion and Venus, but where do I look to see this constellation?
The famous Southern Cross.
Famous Southern Cross. I'll be happy to answer you. Tell me which country you'll be in so I know how far south.
I'll be in Lima, Peru, and the Sacred Valley.
Okay, so that's not like super south. That sounds like about 20 degrees south of the equator. That's plenty to see the Southern Cross. Unfortunately for you, at this time of year, the Southern Cross is at its very lowest point. It circles around the South Celestial Pole just as the Big Dipper circles around the North Celestial Pole. But here, whereas Cassiopeia and the Big Dipper and the other circumpolar constellations like Cepheus, etc., go counterclockwise. Down there, everything moves clockwise around the blank, and there's no South Star. We have a North Star. We have no South Star. Goes clockwise around this very blank part of the sky. So the way you'll find the Southern Cross is, first of all, get away from the lights of town, look around, and really just find the most forlorn, empty, darkest giant section of the sky, and odds are this is where the South Celestial Pole sits. Whirling around that is the Southern Cross, but at this time of year, the first several hours after nightfall, it's at the bottom part of that loop, so it's scraping the horizon. And especially from there, it'll be below the horizon, so you won't see it.
Okay.
So when will you see it? Midnight, because that's when it's on its way up, and at that point you'll see it not as an right side up, but as a mostly upside down, leaning to the left cross on the left side of the south celestial pole, and then it'll get higher and higher. And before dawn, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, that's when it's going to be highest up in the south. Now, one way you'll know you're facing south is if you're really away from the lights of town, look for two bright patches, spots in the sky. Those are the famous Magellanic Clouds. You don't want to miss that. Those are our sister galaxies. People think Andromeda is our closest galaxy. No, these are the closest galaxies, and you only see it from the southern hemisphere. So you'll see these two wonderful patches. Don't miss them. That's the Magellanic Clouds.
Okay.
And, and the fact that those will be high up in the south, that tells you the correct direction to look. That's the direction you'll face between midnight and dawn, and that's the direction you'll face to see the Southern Cross.
Julie, have a great trip.
You guys are the best. Thank you.
Thank you, and tell us how you did when you call in next time on the show. 1-800-348-2551. This one came in via email from Rich Z in Vineland, New Jersey. Hi, Bob and Ray. Hey, wasn't that a comedy team? Well, certainly not us. All right, two questions. You can choose which you think is more interesting or be generous and answer them all. All right, Rich, here we go. Let's see, what you got. One, if a large object hit the moon and smashed it to bits or knocked it out of orbit, what would be the effect on Earth? Quickly, in 30 seconds, go.
Well, each of the fragments would still continue to orbit around Earth as before, unless the impact imparted such large speed that it actually knocked it out of its present orbit around the sun, because the moon actually, more than going around the Earth, it's going around the sun. It's almost like Earth and the moon are sister objects orbiting the sun. But if it wasn't that powerful, then it would just break into pieces and it would still be there. Of course, some of the pieces might have some individual motion. Some of them might make it here and produce a nice meteor shower or two.
Ooh, okay. Question two from Rich Z in Vineland, New Jersey. What is the difference between a globular cluster and a galaxy? Both are a bunch of dense accumulation of stars. What makes a galaxy and what makes the stars in a cluster? Proximity?
Exactly. That's a matter of degree. A globular cluster typically is 500,000 to 1,000,000 stars.
Yeah.
A galaxy will have billions of stars. So you're talking about 1,000 times more material at least in a galaxy than in a globular cluster. Also, the globular clusters are going around a galaxy. We have about 150 of those in our own Milky Way, and each one orbits around the center of our galaxy.
And will eventually...
No. They're in stable orbits. They're not going to join up or anything. They're in stable orbits around the center of our galaxy in Sagittarius, and they all orbit around in a spherical pattern. The rest of the galaxy is shaped like a pancake. It's flat. The globular clusters are going around in spherical orbits in every which way around the center of the galaxy. But as I say, figure a few hundred thousand stars in each, as opposed to billions of stars in a galaxy.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Caroline in Ghent, you're on. Caroline.
Yeah, hi, good afternoon. So my question is the following. When I get off work, which is about 10:15, 10:30, there is in the east, I don't know if it is a star rising. It's above the horizon already, obviously. And it is, how should I describe this? In the line of the feet of the Orion, going further east, about 2.5 lengths.
And it's very bright.
And super bright.
And it sometimes changes color and twinkles a lot.
Yeah, and it seems to be a little bit bluish more.
Oh, that's it. That's it. There's no question about it.
Oh,
you've just absolutely pinned it down as the famous Dog star, Sirius. That's the brightest star in the sky.
Oh, it is a star?
It is. That's the star Sirius.
Oh, my God, this is so amazing. I thought that maybe it's the
a planet of some sort.
No, that's out there.
No. It's beautifully bluish white, just as you say. It's brighter than anything else. And next time you see it, tonight, for example, it should be clear. Follow Orion's belt down and to the left. And the Ryan's belt pretty much points to it. If you go down and, you know, the famous three stars in a row of Orion's belt, just follow that and it pretty much points right to it, down and to the left, and then you can clinch your identification. But it's brighter than anything else, so there's no
question.
Brighter than Venus?
Yeah, I've seen it now for at least the last...
Not brighter than Venus, but Venus is not out then.
So.
Okay. Well, this is exciting. Caroline, now you know what you saw.
All right. Thank you very much.
Gorgeous star. Gorgeous
star.
It's got a little tiny companion to it. It's got a thing that's the mass of the sun, the weight of the sun, but the size of Earth, a white dwarf companion that goes around it once every 35 years. It's really quite an amazing, wonderful star.
How far away is
it? It's 8.65 light years.
That's not that far.
No, it's the very closest star we can see here with our naked eye.
Very interesting. All right, let's go over to Jim in North Pownell, Vermont. Jim, you're up.
Hey, great show, guys.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say that my grandmother was born in 1901. Her name was Genevieve Gould, and she saw Halley's Comet twice in her lifetime.
Oh, yeah.
And the second time she saw it, I was with her.
She was disappointed, huh?
Did you remember if you saw it in the fall of 85 or else, or was it the spring of 86?
Yeah, it was somewhere in 85, 86.
Yeah, that was the autumn. That was the better time to see it. And then unfortunately, after it became visible again, the tail fell off. And so it was really not a very spectacular one. But that's good for her.
It was so neat to just share that moment with my grandmother.
Yeah.
That's great.
My grandmother, too. The same thing, by the way.
And me, too. And you might know that Mark Twain famously was born on the year that Halley's Comet came and died on the year it next came.
That's right. Yeah. Well, thanks, Jim. Appreciate the call.
All right. Great. Keep up the good work.
Thank you very much. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. 1-800-348-2551. Barry in Scotia. Barry.
Hi, this is a kind of a philosophical question, and thank you for the show, by the way.
All right, you guys go ahead.
Just briefly, Einstein believed in causality, and that universe that was not interfered with so much by the observer, whereas Bohr came to the conclusion that reality itself had no causality. So my question is, how can most scientists search for causal connections, and yet physicists continue to believe that at the core of the universe and the atom there is no causality?
You know, this is a wonderful question. Boy, this opens up doors that's a lot of fun to walk through.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
And, Einstein insisted on things like locality, which means that objects are only affected by things in their immediate vicinity, or certainly couldn't be affected by something that didn't have time to get there. You know, you need to travel at the speed of light or nothing faster than that if you're going to influence something else. Whereas, you're right, Niels Bohr and the whole quantum gang showed that objects behave differently when they're observed, and the causality goes out the window because you can have two objects that have never been in contact and are too far away for even light to have had time to go from one to the other, and yet one gets observed or measured, and the other instantaneously changes what it is, even though they could not have touched each other.
And how do they experimentally prove that?
Well, it was really pinned down. Einstein hated this, as our caller correctly pointed out. He said that's what inspired his famous line, "God does not play dice." In other words, you can't just roll the dice and expect random results or probability to dictate things, which is what the quantum gang showed. And so it was controversial.
But how did they resolve this now?
They resolved it in 1998. Before that, you know, Einstein and two other famous physicists in the 1930s, Nathan Rosen and Podolsky, the three of them said that if this were true, then there must be some kind of spooky action at a distance.
Right.
That was his famous pejorative, his put down of this whole idea.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It turned out he was wrong. This is one of those few, you hate to say it because it's his 100th anniversary now of general relativity, but he was just dead wrong on this. In 1998, a scientist in Geneva, Nicolas Gissan, was the first to really pin down why it was wrong. He used particles that were entangled and that were 11 kilometers apart, sent them along optical fibers. And sure enough, when one was observed or had to make a choice to go one way or the other, its entangled twin, almost 7 miles away, instantaneously did the same thing, much faster, at least 5,000 times faster than the speed of light could have spread the news, which was the limit, the testing limit. And then a few years later, David Wineland at the National Institute of Science and Technology, he sealed the deal using heavy particles, not even bits of light anymore, but beryllium ions, heavy things, and showed that, once again, these entangled particles, when one did something, the other instantaneously knew it, even though they were not in contact.
Isn't that akin to the butterfly effect? Because Brian Greene, a lot of physicists kind of ignore this debate entirely as if it's been settled completely, which you say it has. But he says in 1935, Einstein predicted an unpleasant consequence of his own theory of relativity, which was something like the butterfly effect.
Butterfly effect is more like bordering on chaos theory, where one thing affects another and that affects another in ways that has a greater effect than the initial consequences would
dictate.
But
very far away from each other in time and space.
Yeah. But this certainly demolished what we called Cartesian or classical science, where we thought that locality ruled. In other words, certainly, you know, a leaf can be stirred by a gust of wind in its vicinity, but that leaf is not going to tremble because of a peasant riot in the Andromeda Galaxy instantaneously. But again, the quantum gang showed that, nope, it's not like that.
Barry, thanks a lot for the call. Now, how do particles become entangled? Presumably, some are not entangled.
Right. Well, they'd have to be born entangled together. For example, you could entangle light by sending a pulse of light into certain type of crystals, like barium borate, for example, where you have a higher energy bit of light that goes in, and two photons of light come out. Now, each one has twice the wavelength or half the energy, so there's no cheating. There's no gain. There's no net gain of energy because the same energy goes out and came in, but now you have two objects. They were born together, and even though they're flying off in opposite directions and are never in contact, each knows of the other's existence, or let's say potential existence, because nothing has existence until it's observed. You observe one, and then it leaves its probabilistic potential, and we say its wave function collapses until it becomes an actual photon with certain characteristics, for example, polarization, horizontal. Okay. And then the other twin, even if it's on two galaxies away, in real time, as if there's no space between them, instantaneously becomes a real photon, but with complementary particles properties, so that if the first one had a horizontal polarization, the other one will have a vertical polarization.
Okay.
So the two together combined have all the possible properties that you could have.
Well, we really don't know if it would work two galaxies away. We know it works 7 miles apart.
Exactly, yes, yes,
so
yes.
So how do you do that with a heavier particle? You mentioned an ion being used. Now, it's one thing with photons or with light, but how do you do that with a heavier particle?
He did it, again, at the National Institute of Science. I actually met the guy back a few years ago, David Wineland, and his apparatus right there at NIST produced, again, first you have to produce the particles that are entangled, and then you have to measure their properties, which only
properties. With particles that have such mass, how do you produce entangled particles?
In this particular case, when you're dealing with objects with mass instead of light, then you're looking for different properties, for example, spin. You're not looking for polarization. So it's an entirely different set of parameters. Don't ask me anymore.
All right. Well, I don't like this magic business. Let's go back to the phones. Andrew in Greenfield Center. Andrew, you're on.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good. Nice to have you here.
Okay. So I've got this kind of a ham radio astrological thing.
Okay.
But I was listening to WAMC late last June, and I know I was listening to Mountain Stage, and every now and then in the winter, I get some static. So it's like, no big deal. Yeah, something's not right. And it was static, and it faded out, and I listened, like, oh, don't adjust my radio, and it faded in, and I, no, that's not WMC, and it faded out, faded in, but it went, and I'm not kidding you, I got Iowa Public Radio.
Cool.
And then what I want to say is I know I used to be a big fan of CB radio and ham radio.
Yeah.
And the ionosphere and stuff bouncing off stuff, and yeah, that makes sense, but not at 90.3 megahertz. That's just short term, like
that's 90. VHF. And so yeah. You may have had meteor scatter. That's the type. It usually doesn't work on FM, but you can actually bounce signals. I guess the meteors have ionic clouds that travel with them. So sometimes you can bounce signals off that. It could have been tropospheric ducting. It could have been some. I certainly believe that happened to you.
Oh yeah, no. I was just amazed that with AM radio, yeah, with 50 kilowatts, yeah, okay, I can hear something in Iowa, but with just the FM radio is a lot low power, and I heard that, and it was Iowa Public Radio.
So
I'm
cool.
In upstate New York, that's that. And was there a CME? Was there a big CME that happened there?
When was this?
Well, we can pinpoint it to Mountain Stage Monday night, June 24th or June 22nd.
June 24th?
Yeah.
I don't even remember last weekend.
So. Hey, hang in there, Andrew. We're going to take a break. I'll leave you on the line,
okay.
And then we'll explore this. We're going to take a break right now. It's Vox Pop, 1-800-348-2551, and we'll be back.
Support for WAMC comes from the Honest Weight Food Co-op, 100 Waterfleet Avenue, Albany, New York, specializing in local and organic produce, natural groceries, fine cheeses, locally raised meats, and ready-to-go organic meals, honestweight.coop. Carrie Haddad Gallery, Hudson, presenting Radical Inventions, an exhibit of futuristic paintings, drawings, and sculptures on view now and through December 27th, open daily, carriehaddadgallery.com. The Preservation League of New York State, Albany, New York, announcing their updated website with more information about membership, grants, and loans, so our past has a future, preservenys.org. Empire Exhibits and Displays, Mechanicville, New York, custom exhibits, interactive media displays, and commercial casework for corporate interiors, museum installations, and trade shows, empireexhibits.com. And Careers in Transition, LLC, Albany. Dr. Tom Denham, providing career guidance, testing, job strategies, interview preparation, LinkedIn lessons, resume and cover letter writing, careersintransitionllc.com.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Hey, the weirdness indicates Bob Berman is here, and by golly, he is in the house today. We talk astronomy and other things with Bob every month or so. Number to call is 800-348-2551. Andrew in Greenfield Center posed a question. Interesting phenomenon. Listening to WAMC last June 24th, and some fuzz, some atmospheric haze, and all of a sudden, Iowa Public Radio came in.
I don't know.
You don't know?
No. I don't. This is
okay. I mean, yeah. It's in. I wonder if, in fact, his question about the CME was right, and maybe there was a strong aurora. You can get auroral propagation at VHF. I'm not used to hearing about it at FM FM.
That's the thing that freaked me out. It's like AM radio, fine, 50,000 watts at 890 kilohertz. Yeah, you can get to half the world, but not at 90 megahertz.
Oh, but no, you can get auroral propagation at that frequency. It's the fact that FM is such a wide band signal. In other words, if you were running sideband, which is a very narrow signal, or Morse code, CW, that happens much more often. But FM is so wide. Hey, man, Bob has no answer. I have no answer. But nice call, Andrew.
Okay. Can I just get a confirmation? Was there a big CME around June 24th or 2nd?
We've had a few this year, but I don't remember the dates.
We'd have to check. You could probably check that online.
I'll go to spaceweather.com and check it out.
Hey, Andrew, thanks. Great call. We appreciate it. Here's one from email. This is from Joe. Earlier this week at around 5 a.m., I saw three bright lights as the moon was setting. Largest in the east, one due south from us, the other closer to the moon in the west. I'm thinking all were planets. Can you clarify?
5 a.m.
Yep.
5 a.m., you would have had, again, Sirius, the dog star that wonderful caller phoned about earlier. Rises nowadays maybe around 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock. So by 5 a.m., it's going to be in the west. So that's going to be your object in the west.
Close to the moon.
In the east, you'll have Venus.
Okay.
And that's gorgeous. Jupiter is returning. So those will be the two brightest objects in the east before dawn.
What about the one due south of Joe?
Due south at that hour? Well, there you've got Orion and his friends. So that could be anything. In the south, you've got a lot of bright stars. The dog star would be in the southwest, so maybe that's what he means.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for that email, Joe. Let's go over to John and Clinton. John, you're on.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. Quick question. I know that you were talking about black holes before. Is a black hole just another name for a gravitational singularity, or are they different?
They're different in that the singularity describes the object itself that's producing all the gravitational effects. In other words, there's the collapsed star, or if it's a supermassive black hole, like the 4 million solar mass black hole in the center of our galaxy, the collapsed object, whatever it is, that has now, according to general relativity, if only that is in play, collapses to have zero volume and infinite density. Now, what does that mean? That has no physical meaning, but that's the singularity. Now, surrounding it at a certain distance, at the Schwarzschild radius, depending upon its mass, called the Schwarzschild radius, which is the radius from that, and that all depends on its mass, at which the event horizon occurs. Now, the event horizon is the distance from the singularity at which escape would be impossible because it's at the speed of light. At least natural escape would be impossible. In other words, any object falling in from that point closer in can't escape. So generally, in practice, we talk about black holes being the whole shebang, being the event horizon, which is at least miles from the singularity, the spiraling in pancake-shaped material called the accretion disk just outside of the event horizon where material is going in faster and faster. And that whole shebang is commonly called the black hole. But the singularity is a little dot in the center. But because it defies the laws of science as we know them, some think that something must prevent the singularity from ever forming, and that there is no singularity, and that as the object collapses smaller and smaller and smaller, something stops it, since infinite density is impossible and zero volume has no meaning. Perhaps the strong force comes into play in ways we don't understand and prevents the singularity from ever forming.
Did you get all that, John?
I will try to digest it. Thank you very much.
Me too. Don't hurt your brain. Let's go to David, who's on the highway. Where are you, David?
I'm on the highway somewhere between New York and Vermont.
Okay, are you hands-free?
Yep, I'm hands-free.
All right, then go ahead with your question for Bob.
All right. Say you have two particles that are entangled, two light particles, and you sent one to a nearby galaxy or star. Could you somehow use the two for instantaneous communication?
That's the key question. The experts say no. They say that everything about particle entanglement or EPR correlations is random. So that, for example, upon measurement or observation of the first object, it then leaves its probabilistic, blurry, anything's possible existence and becomes an actual, you said light, so let's stick with that, becomes an actual photon of light with properties that appear randomly. We don't know whether it's going to have a horizontal or a vertical polarization. We don't know any of that. It's just going to happen on its own. And at that moment, its entangled twin, no matter its location, even if it's on the other side of the universe, will instantaneously collapse to become an actual photon also with the complementary particles. Now, the way we could send a message is if somehow our observation of the first particle, we could force it to have a particular property, then we'd know its entangled twin elsewhere would have the complementary one, and then we could send information by deliberately creating a certain, let's say, polarization.
Like a binary situation?
Exactly. And then we could send information faster than the speed of light, in fact, infinitely fast, by that method. But they say that, no, the results are always random, and because they're random, we can't use it. We can't employ it for communications. And therefore Einstein stays safe. And the people who strictly believe in relativity say that, well, then that lets us off the hook, because Einstein said nothing travels faster than light. Well, we know now that that's wrong, because this quantum information travels infinitely fast. That's faster than light. But the relativity people say, well, that still doesn't violate what we really meant, because we can't send information faster than light.
Okay. All right, very good. Well, David, does your head hurt?
Yeah, a little bit. It always does when I think about stuff like this.
Yeah, me too, but you're driving, so be very careful.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for the call. 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. By the way, we had a caller on hold who could not hold, who said the issue where AMC was fading out in June and Iowa was coming on was sporadic E. And that's another type of propagation that signals in the VHF range can use, and it's common in the summer. So that's probably the answer.
Okay.
Very good. Well, let's go to Chris in Albany. Chris.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Glad I got a hold of you.
You're on.
On Thanksgiving, we're having dinner. My father said he was up Wednesday night, as he often is, looking out the window, and saw the space station.
Cool.
And it was going up and down. He thought it would be orbiting. It was in the southeast.
Well, why wouldn't it have been orbiting if it were moving in a seemingly vertical direction? I mean, the whole sky, a thing in orbit can be seen to move in any direction in the sky except for one.
Well, it would go up, because I saw it the following night.
He said it was bobbing up and down.
Oh, you mean going up and then going back down again, reversing direction?
I suggest to you that's not the space station.
No, that's not the space station. What could that be? That suggests some sort of maybe local drone or airplane that was changing.
It was the brightest thing in the sky except for the moon.
Well, nonetheless.
Well, you know, I've seen when we were up on vacation at the beach, We had good view of the space station, and it is very bright, but it just travels in a straight line.
Hmm.
It does. Okay, well, must have been an imposter, I guess.
I don't know, man. Keep watching the skies.
Well, he had read somewhere that in that direction at night it was going to be the space station. But anyway.
Yeah, it's seen in almost every direction except east to west. You'll never see an orbiting satellite moving east to west.
Hmm.
Why is that?
Okay.
Because they're all launched
Thanks,
in the direction that Earth is spinning. It gives it an extra bit of oomph. You know, we're at our equator. We're rotating 1,038 miles an hour. So rockets, payloads, orbiting anything are always launched in that direction. So they're automatically given a free 1,000-mile-per-hour extra speed boost.
Yeah.
To launch it the other way, there'd be no purpose, because then you'd be fighting Earth's rotation and losing that 1,000 miles per hour right from the get-go without any gain. So consequently, you'll never see a satellite moving toward the west, towards the sunset.
All right. Over to Jim in Albany. Jim.
Hi. The Geminid meteor showers. In which direction should we look?
Oh, thank you for asking that. That we should have mentioned that earlier. It's really going to be anywhere in the sky. It comes from the meteors all streak from the constellation Gemini, duh. And Gemini rises at around 9 o'clock or so, 9:30. But even before it clears the northeastern horizon, meteors will be streaking across the sky. So this is one of those rare great meteor showers that, starting at 8, especially 9 p.m., anywhere in the sky, you'll see them. And then after that, as the night goes on, you might think you'd see more by looking towards Gemini, that is to the upper left of Orion. But since that's their origin, the meteors in that direction tend to be short, because they're coming straight toward you.
Yeah.
So you actually see better meteors by looking 90 degrees from there, looking, let's say, toward the south or looking toward the north in another direction, because then you see them sideways and they put on better shows.
Okay, thank you.
Jim, thank you. Over to Michael in Schenectady. Michael.
Hi there. I just wanted to ask a question about the last call about the detecting particle spin across the vast spaces and thereby being the speed of light.
Okay, sure.
All right, so the question is, I know that certain materials, like radioactive materials, will affect the spin of an electron, for instance. And if we were to use something like that radioactive material specifically in order to affect that spin, could we then use that to detect it as opposed to just trying to read the spin originally?
Well, in terms of detecting it, if we're really talking about EPR correlations or entangled particles, remember, it's the observation. Without the observation, you don't really have existence in the way we think of existence. So you're going to be detecting, if it's an electron that's, let's say, entangled, you're going to detect it by some means. If you're looking for spin, then you're going to see spin. If you're looking for motion, you'll see motion. That works with anything that you're detecting. When you look for a property, that's the property that's going to exist. And another property is not going to show itself, except you're going to have to infer it probabilistically.
Yeah, but there's some effects, for instance, on the spin of an electron that can be caused by certain materials. And if we know we can get, let's say, a left spin off of some radioactive material, won't we in fact know that spin of that entangled electron in another location as well?
No, because if there's more than one choice, and there always is with entangled particles, you have complementary choices with, you said it yourself, in terms of little solid bits of material, spin is one of them. With light, it can be polarization. But there's always going to be two choices, complementary choices. And when you observe one, when it pops into existence, it's going to be one or the other. It's never going to be, you're never going to know what you're going to get until you make the observation. Because the whole idea of the particle entanglement is that there are always two choices in each of these properties.
Right, but if the choice is limited because of the direct action of the particle, then the choice should be limited on the other one as well.
Well, if you're in a matrix where it's limited, I'm trying to think of a thing where you didn't have those choices to begin with when you make the observation. For example, if you're observing light, getting back to that 1998 Geneva experiment of Nicolas Gissan, when you had two choices, in that case going through essentially a two-way mirror where you could either bounce off or penetrate that, and the entangled particle had the same choice,
right.
You always have a 50-50 choice on either of them. You're not going to pop into existence with only one. Now, once it's created, once it pops into existence, you can subject it to other factors in the environment. And, for example, electron, you mentioned it with an electrical charge of minus one. Sure, you could use a magnetic field and deflect it in a way that you could predict. And then but until it's come into existence, it doesn't have that.
Okay. If I was more specific, I would say I remember a Scientific American article that was written a while back. They were talking about detecting the difference between dummy warheads and live warheads. And in the article, it said that they had detectors that could pick up the spin of electrons, and that's how they could determine which of the multiple warhead systems were actually live.
That's amazing.
That is amazing. And Michael, I got to say, this has been an interesting program. And Michael, thank you for that call. Very quickly, let's go over to Richard in Richmond, Mass. Richard, you only have about 15 seconds, so go ahead.
Hi. Talking about communication with entangled particles, my question is, if you are able to control, let's say, three pairs of entangled particles, could you then communicate by just having a Morse code of, you know, two on, one off, or something like that?
All right.
No matter what their resultant is.
12 seconds, Bob.
Well, you couldn't, because the moment that it pops into existence, you're not controlling, even if you have more than one of them, each one of them is going to pop into existence independently, and you're not going to control the property. You're not going to control the spin when it first emerges, and you're not going to control the polarization when it first emerges. The fact of particle entanglement is, upon observation, it will have one of a set of complementary particles. I want to use my final 5 seconds just to mention that Tuesday is the darkest afternoon of the year, and starting this coming Wednesday, we're going to get brighter. So those who are weary of winter, even though winter is a couple of weeks away, Wednesday, you're going to start getting, it's going to start only a few seconds at first, you're going to start with a later sunset and a brighter afternoon.
All
Wednesday.
Right, Bob, thank you. Support comes from NBT Bank, offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses. NBTBank.com. Lori Stillwell, CPA, PC, providing tax and accounting services for businesses and their owners, Saratoga Springs and beyond. StillwellCPA.com. Quality Foreign Car Care, Boston Spa, New York. Sales and service of Audi, BMW, Mercedes, Volvo, Saab, Volkswagen, and Porsche. QFCC.com. And Mango Tree Import, Saratoga Springs, New York. Offering fairly traded nativities and holiday ornaments handcrafted by artisans from all over the world. Open 7 days a week. MangoTreeImports.com. Thanks again to the great Bob Berman. Thanks to the great Zach Malloy at the controls. Your phones were answered today by Deb Malik. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein. Marshall, I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's a Food Friday. So let's clear our mind from the last hour and try to get through the day.